Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen today. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. The United States has a number of medically uninsured and underinsured people. The federal-state partnership known as Medicaid has become the only available insurer for a growing number of Americans. With the federal government seeking ways to cut medical costs, the burden increasingly falls on the states to pick up the tab. This is an election year in which Illinois voters will select a governor, congressional representatives, and members of the state legislature. Many of these candidates have offered specific policies they would pursue with regard to Medicaid. The above facts argue for you, as a responsible citizen and concerned voter, to pay attention during this hour of Focus 580 because we intend to discuss the particulars of this whole Medicaid thing and about the positions of the candidates. We have two guests to provide some expert analysis. Bob Rich is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. He also has joint appointments in the College of Medicine, the Political Science Department, and the College of Law, among other things. Wincor is dean and professor in the School of Social Work here at the University of Illinois. Her doctorate is in psychology, and her research interests are mental health policy and services. And we'll talk about some of those things, a lot of those things, during this hour of Focus 580 with Bob Rich and Wincor as we discuss Medicaid and the candidates, focusing this time on children and mental health. Also want to mention a television program that is airing on WILL-TV that our guests are involved in. The show is called Electing Healthcare. It will air on WILL-TV on Friday, September 29th from 8 to 9 p.m. This is a series of shows that we are producing in association with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, the School of Social Work, the University of Illinois College of Law, and others related to healthcare issues in the election. And it's a good chance for you to get some good information, insight, analysis, and to ask your own questions. So if you'd like to tune in for that, please feel free to do so. Also, if you want to call in during today's show, our lines are yours. If you want to ask questions, that's the point of the show, is to provide you the best guidance we possibly can on these issues. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And to Bob Rich and Wincor, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here. So let's begin with the question about Medicaid in general. And either of you, please feel free to chime in on this. How bad is it? What is the scale of the problem with financing the Medicaid system in relation to the number of people it is being called upon to serve and other economic factors?
Well, I would say that Medicaid is the number one issue for every governor in the United States. Some people would call it the 900-pound gorilla. And the reason for that is that this is a federal-state program, meaning it's financed both by the federal government, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 80% of the costs, and by the state government, somewhere between 30 and 50%. Illinois happens to be one of the 50-50 states. And that has to do with the formula for calculating Medicaid. But one of the reasons that makes this such a controversial program is that every percentage point makes a huge difference. So Indiana, for example, is in the 52-53% range. Mm-hmm. Alabama is an 80-20 state. So this is a program that is very financially demanding, in part for the reasons that you said about the number of uninsured and underinsured folks, and in part because of the number of services that it covers, including nursing home care and mental health care and kid care. So it is a extraordinarily important program.
I think one of the things we have to think about is why we have Medicaid and how it differs from Medicare. So to do a little bit of history, if we think back to 1935 when we created Social Security to help older people and then the groups that we used to call the aged, blind, and disabled to have some income support so they could make it, we didn't include health care. It took until the mid-1960s to realize that government had a responsibility that went along with, you know, the subsistence side of this to help people in those groups when they were in need of health care. And Medicaid and Medicare were enacted in 1965, with Medicare focusing on people who were eligible for Social Security, and Medicaid focusing on those other groups, people with disabilities, young mothers who were raising their small children, and they were responsible for them. So those groups are the groups that became covered by Medicaid. And by the 70s, there was a special program within Social Security for them called Supplemental Security Income, which we call SSI. And those groups are Medicaid-eligible people.
So Medicaid essentially became the insurer, the healthcare insurer of last resort for people who weren't in the Social Security or Medicare system.
Right. So, for example, people with disabilities who could not work because of their disabilities and therefore weren't getting insurance in the private market through their workplace like other people, this was the only way that they could have health care coverage.
So, Jack, to talk about Illinois, just to give some figures here. In 2004, of Illinois' 12.7 million residents, 14% were uninsured, 21% had either Medicare or Medicaid, with Medicaid being 9%, and 63% had private insurance. So we're talking about a large group of people, and we have some folks who have both Medicare and Medicaid because they qualify for both programs.
Okay. So we're talking about millions of people that the program covers in Illinois alone. And as is probably no surprise, that healthcare costs continue to escalate. I don't know the latest figures. Perhaps that's something that you have also studied faster than the rate of general inflation, certainly.
That's correct. And healthcare and number of uninsured nationally has gone up. At one point in time, about 5 years ago, it was down to 42 million. We're now back up to 47 million Americans who are uninsured, and costs now represent 16% of our gross domestic product. So it's the single largest domestic expenditure for healthcare.
One factor driving more people into the uninsured category, probably worth mentioning, is a lot of the employer healthcare insurance programs are under pressure or being eliminated.
And indeed, it used to be the case that if you had private health insurance, 66% was provided by employer-based insurance. We're now down to 60%. So that level is going down. And moreover, the benefits provided through employer-based health insurance is going down. So even in the private market, there's growing pressure both from employers and employees to deal with ever-rising healthcare costs and healthcare insurance premium costs.
In your background paper, which I should mention is available on the Electing Healthcare website, which is electinghealthcare.org, really simple to find, there's a background paper in which you note that the positions embraced by the candidates demonstrate their views not only about healthcare, but also about other issues relative to the economy, the role of the private sector and the public sector, et cetera. You know, that sort of a philosophical, you know, I mean, if you look at their position, you can see, you know, what's the role of government, private sector, et cetera.
Right. And Governor Blagojevich and Treasurer Topinka have, because health care is such an important problem, have devoted some time to looking at their health care positions and what should be done about health care. And Treasurer Topinka has been particularly concerned with cost containment issues. And Governor Blagojevich has been particularly concerned with his All Kids program and his Health Care Justice Act, which he passed it as well, which is designed to increase access for this underinsured and uninsured population.
Well, you note the debate surrounding Medicaid during this election focus on two sort of opposing forces, increasing access and controlling costs.
Correct.
Yes.
And they're kind of at odds. I mean, if you increase access, you're going to probably increase costs.
Well, we have to worry a bit that you can increase access as a goal, but does it happen in reality? Are there providers out there who are, first of all, are they out there at all? Second, are they out there and willing to accept the particular program like Medicaid. There are a lot of providers who are restricting who they will take on Medicaid because payments have been delayed and so on. Mm. So just by saying there's a program doesn't necessarily translate into increased access for the person seeking care.
Let's follow up on that particular point. The provider does not have to take Medicaid patients. Is that correct?
There's no legal obligation. Yeah. There is. I mean, providers have a right to refuse care. And as long as they're not violating the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which so they're not doing on the basis of race or religion or gender, they're not obligated to accept Medicaid patients. And as Wynn suggested, many of them don't accept Medicaid patients because of delayed reimbursement and because of level of reimbursement. I mean, right now we're down to a real gap between charges and levels of reimbursement. So many states are only giving 48 cents on the dollar back in terms of the charges for Medicaid rates.
And in the mental health field, we have an additional layer of problems because not all people who are licensed providers are covered under the Illinois Medicaid rules. So, for example, in our region of the state, where some of the key mental health providers are what we call technically licensed behavioral health care providers, like clinical social workers, they aren't included right now under the Illinois Medicaid rules. So they, if they're working in a family service agency, they can't be reimbursed for Medicaid. So while on the one hand, you might think that, oh, great, we have some more people covered under Medicaid or an alternate program like Kids Care, there might not, in fact, be a provider there at all who's licensed and eligible under Illinois rules.
And yet some of those people who are not eligible might be the appropriate person to provide care.
Oh, yes. And sometimes the only, because south of Metro Chicago, for example, there are very few child psychiatrists. Mm. So you are looking at other providers who are very qualified and are licensed, but not covered under the Illinois Medicaid rule at this point.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things with regard to access is, as you know, south of Interstate 80. I mean, Illinois, the population thins out, except for, you know, population centers like Champaign, Urbana, Bloomington, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of the rural areas, there just aren't that many healthcare providers.
No, there aren't, and it doesn't mean that there isn't a great need for services. You know, somehow risk doesn't disappear. For example, in recent years, we know that there's been a growing number of children who've been very traumatized by things like parental methamphetamine abuse and in need of highly specialized services and very few places that are able to offer those services.
And so as a consequence, Jack, we have some so-called Medicaid mills. And Medicaid mills are practices that only deal with Medicaid patients. And those have grown up over time, they're especially in urban areas. And they've grown up over time because many physicians won't accept Medicaid patients. And incidentally, to go just a moment back to history, that's not what President Johnson had in mind when Medicare and Medicaid was passed. He thought about Medicaid as being another insurance card that would allow people to have access to the health care the way you and I have access to health care, and it hasn't turned out that way.
I know I lived in Pennsylvania for a few years before I moved back to Illinois 4 years ago, and when they expanded their coverage for children under a program called SCHIP, one of the things they found to be particularly effective was that people did have a card that looked and worked like an insurance card. It reduced the stigma of having the Medicaid card, and they really did improve access, although they had a lot of complicated issues. These programs always do, but they tried to deal with exactly that issue.
So just to follow up on the Medicaid mills, boy, I just confused it myself, didn't I? What is their rationale? I mean, is this a good or a bad thing? What is their role? Or
well, they do provide access, and when there aren't other routes to getting services, so they frequently are in communities where there aren't other providers. So, mm-hmm. you know, they're an important provider. The question often becomes, you know, issues of quality.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And also with respect to the Medicaid meals, it's a question of there is the stigma attached to it. Yeah. And there is the issue of many times these Medicaid meals are only staffed by foreign-born physicians or new doctors who are just coming to the United States from foreign countries who can't get jobs elsewhere. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a quality issue, but it does certainly reinforce different tracks of care that we have in the United States.
Now, this issue of the stigma of having Medicaid as opposed to, you know, some other higher status health care insurance, does that act as a barrier then to people even getting into the Medicaid program? Do we know that?
Yes, I think we do know that. I think any of us, you know, think a bit about ourselves and what anything in which you have to label yourself as somebody who isn't somehow fully a citizen. You know, I'm not working right now and I have this benefit, whether it's, you know, a food stamp or a Medicaid card. It's really difficult to say, I need help now because I'm not providing in the way I thought I would be providing as an adult and have insurance and have the kind of work that provides insurance. Lots of people in this who are eligible for Medicaid or for themselves and or their children are people who are working. But it's somehow, you know, I would feel really bad if I had to say, you know, I can't provide for my kids. I've had students stand up in class and talk about the issues they have in having coverage for their children. And I'm like, ah, that's one of my students standing in front of me talking about how she has no insurance coverage and what the barriers are.
And now think about it from the standpoint of a provider. So let's think about Carle Care here in town and why Carle Care might be reluctant to accept Medicaid patients or any additional Medicaid patients. And I'd say there are at least two factors associated with that. One of them is the delayed payments from the state, although it is true that Governor Blagojevich, through the Department of Health and Family Services, which is our Medicaid agency, has done a significantly improved job in terms of the delayed payments on Medicaid. So delayed payments is one hand, and the other one is the level of reimbursement. So the level of reimbursement that you get from the state on Medicaid is not the same level of reimbursement that you get from Medicare, and not the same level of reimbursement that you might get from private insurance. And when providers are operating on small margins of operations, their ability to provide uncompensated care is very small. And so they fear, I think understandably, fear that if they accept more Medicaid patients, they will have a higher level of uncompensated care, and that will affect their overall ability to operate. And let's remember that we've had, over the last 10 years, more and more hospitals and emergency rooms in particular closing down, both in Illinois and around the country.
We're talking this morning during this hour, Focus 580, about Medicaid and, in particular, its relationship to health care insurance and coverage and access for children and people in need of mental health services. Our guests are Bob Rich, Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and Wynn Kaur, Dean of the School of Social Work, both here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We have one caller waiting and would welcome others. If you want to join us, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone here in Champaign County, line number one. Good morning.
Hi. Since you brought up Carle just before, while I was waiting to go on, it's interesting to note that there was a report this morning on WLL's news about the ongoing inquiry into whether Carle can be regarded as a nonprofit institution or not. So that might have something to do with their calculations as opposed to just whether they can maintain themselves in their various edifices locally. Hope that isn't too dripping. The what I wanted to ask about was just, since it seems we've gone, we're focusing on the whole healthcare system and the flaws of Medicare, part of that. I noticed that the last two people that were on from this Electing Healthcare series, at the very end of the show, they were asked about cost savings through a single-payer system, expanding the pool, and both of them were just very negative about that. And I wonder whether these two of the four, I guess there are, that are on this series, are also not aware that other countries in the world use other ways of putting more money that is called health care expenses into actual delivering health care. So I also would like to know if either of these or any of these four, if they know, have participated in the Health Care Justice Act series of hearings that were going around in the U.S. This was in Illinois, right, pertaining to a state law that is seizing with the idea that how can Illinois actually provide health care to everyone?
So, okay.
So well, you've asked three different questions, and so let me try to comment on each of them a little bit, and then Wynn can as well. The whole issue of the not-for-profit status of hospitals, Carl and Pravina in our city and others around the country, has a lot to do with this issue of what level of uncompensated care do you provide, and what government is saying through their regulatory mechanisms is if you do not provide enough uncompensated care, you can't be considered a not-for-profit institution. And all as I was trying to say was that there's a dilemma here for these institutions. And the dilemma is how much uncompensated care can I provide when the Medicaid program is paying far less on the dollar than I get from either Medicare or from private insurance. Now, question number two is, you're absolutely correct. The United States is the only country in the world where health care is not a legal right of citizenship, and that every other major industrialized country has some form of national health insurance, either by mandating that every citizen has a right to health insurance, as in Germany, or by a national health service, as in Great Britain or Canada. Not all of these, however, are single-payer systems. I mean, the German example is one where it is an employer-employee-mandated system, and the government's not providing the financing. The government is providing the mandate. And so, as a consequence, 99% of the population in Germany is covered by health insurance. So I don't think single payer is the only possible solution. I think as we talk about solutions for reform, that we need to consider also the role of mandates as well, and saying that everybody has a right to insurance. That, to me, is the first step, is the right issue. And the third question is the Healthcare Justice Act hearings, and the answer to that is yes. I have participated in some of those, and I consider the Healthcare Justice Act to be a very important contribution by the Blagojevich administration to trying to increase access and equity in our state.
I'll comment on the second question, which is really a question about, in its deepest level, are we ever going to have a full major reform of our healthcare system and financing? And I can only say I hope that we get to a point where we have the leadership from not just political leaders, but business leaders to say that we have to tackle this, instead of thinking back to the Clinton era when everyone went after each other and said, no, this is the wrong, everybody's suggestion was the wrong way to go. I guess I'll be an idealist for a moment and hope that we end up with real leadership, both political and from the business community, that says this is one of the most important issues in our country and we should come up with creative ways to do it, whether it's single payer or some other hybrid system. We're an awfully smart country with a lot of ability to innovate, and we ought to be able to do this.
But the first is the political will to actually create a legal right.
Yeah.
Because health care in our country is still a privilege as opposed to a legal right. That's, to me, the first step.
It seems from Chicago we have this example of Walmart, and I don't think this is a digression, because as a living wage, it included $3 towards a health insurance policy, and that was a mandate, and we see how long it lasted, and the fact that it was the only veto that Bailey has ever cast in 18 years or something like that. So mandating corporations is it doesn't look like there's a lot of there's obviously there was the will of the city councilors to go that way, but the complexity of it and even getting something through like that, and I gather one would say, well, you must do it systemically, you can't just pick on big box stores or something, but one would say one either needs to start somewhere and on one little detail, or one needs to make the argument that there should be a overall reform.
I think it's a very good point, and one also looks to what other states have tried. Massachusetts has tried now a program to widely increase access through Governor Romney, and the state of Hawaii back in 1974 had a program which indeed did mandate health insurance as well. So it's not as if we don't have some examples. I mean, again, I'd say to you, this is an issue of political will, not an issue of smarts or an issue of not having ideas.
Very good. We're a little past our midpoint here. Our guests are Bob Rich, Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and Wynn Kaur, Dean of the School of Social Work here at the University of Illinois, talking about Medicaid issues, in particular children and mental health. And we welcome your calls if you want to join us, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-9455. Your questions on this topic are certainly welcome. Just sort of tagging on the last discussion of some of these examples of other states that are doing things, Illinois has one example in the All Kids program that was announced, I guess, a couple of years ago. I forget exactly how long it was, but it basically guarantees coverage through Medicaid if a child is uninsured. So it expands, at least for children, the intent is to eliminate under or uninsurance.
And actually, Illinois is for some time has had a children's health insurance program. We used to call it Kid Care program, and it was part of the state children's health insurance program, which dates back to 1997. The Kid Care program was enacted actually a year ago now by the legislature as part of the veto session last year. And you're right, the idea here is to increase access for any eligible child. The question here is whether or not we have the resources to actually fully implement that program. But it's an extension of what the last caller talked about, the Healthcare Justice Act, and I think that here Illinois is a leader. I mean, it's a leader in designing and implementing a program that could be a very important model for other states.
And it's interesting too, because families have to pay in too. It's not just a free program. It's one in which, according to income level, families participate in the cost of the program. Mm-hmm.
And that was an important part of the design here, that it would be a sliding scale, so that if you truly could not afford a contribution, yes, it was provided for you, but sliding scale co-payments by families as well.
Well, I reserve the right to follow up on the All Kids thing, because I think there's a lot more we should talk about there. We have another caller to include. Let's talk with them and see what they have to ask. Someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Hi. I think that we need to have the community, have voters show leadership, because politicians get punished if they are seen to be raising taxes. And I find it interesting that in this country and in our letters to the editor and so forth, you hear a lot of talk about protecting innocent life And innocent life seems to be embryos and fetuses, and you're only innocent until you're born, which I find to be, you know, really interesting. We're only interested in protecting life until it's born, and as long as it doesn't cost us anything out of our own pockets. You know, it doesn't cost people anything to say you can't have an abortion or you can't have access to birth control, things like this. But when it comes to putting money down for making sure that everybody has basic health care, we're not willing to do that because it costs money out of our pockets and you're no longer innocent. And I think, too, we also need to have a dialogue about the fact that we actually are rationing health care. And we're causing death because we're not making sure people have access to the basics, and we're not asking, we're not making it, we're not finding ways to have people do the things that need to be done, like losing weight, stopping smoking, et cetera, all of us over quite a range. And we're also not talking about not doing heroic things and expensive things at the end of our lives when it really is very costly, and by doing that we're depriving other people of access to health care because we're putting resources into that. So, not a question, just a comment. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks for the call. Well, any reaction to that?
She said she raised many issues around which there could be a great deal of dialogue and debate in the communities, and there should be.
Well, I noted that there was a story yesterday. A new study shows that the level of lead that is present in many children is more damaging to their cognitive or learning abilities. In other words, they're suffering from ADHD and other kinds of learning disabilities in ways that we hadn't fully recognized before, and also because of smoking, prenatal smoking by the parents. And you know, these are issues that cost a lot of money to fix after the fact.
I would make one comment, Jack, about this caller, because she made what I consider to be an extremely important point, which is reforming the healthcare system is not simply a matter for government. Mm-hmm. Reforming the healthcare system is a dialogue and negotiation between clients, providers, third-party payers, insurance companies, and citizens as a whole. And one of the reasons why I think we have such a crisis in our healthcare system is because we don't have a consensus on what the appropriate relationship should be between citizens on the one hand and government on the other with respect to healthcare. And so deliberations like she was suggesting are extremely important, and we're not going to get reform of healthcare until there is community-based leadership.
Well, this brings to mind for me the role of the media in facilitating or maybe, you know, kind of limiting debate or discussion on these things, because it seems like, you know, one of the things that she mentioned was, you know, the idea of someone, a politician or a candidate who says, well, we need to raise taxes to pay for things. Mm-hmm. You know, immediately that then becomes, you're a tax and spend liberal, or you're for big government, mm-hmm. you know, and it sort of gets, the dialogue gets shortchanged because we use these labels that don't actually reflect the full reality that we're having to deal with.
I think I'll repeat two things that Bob said. We need political will to talk about these things, and we do need citizen-raised dialogue. But I think there's some interesting things happening. I was reading the front page of the New York Times this morning, and they were talking about campaigns such as Governor Schwarzenegger's in California, where Republican candidates are looking more like liberal Democratic candidates in some of the issues they're taking on. So I think some of the political leaders, regardless of party affiliation, are seeing that there are key issues that have to be dealt with in their own state. They're willing to maybe take some hits, but raise those issues. I think that's the kind of political will we need to see.
And I think there's some other trends going on besides Medicaid that are worth talking about. And the trend is fewer employers are providing benefits as well. And there's a growing number of people in the 18 to 35-year-old age group who, even if they could purchase health insurance, aren't purchasing health insurance.
Well, that's interesting. Well, let me just mention again that we are talking about Medicaid and children and mental health, a variety of issues with regard to Medicaid this morning with Bob Rich, Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and Wynn Kaur, Dean of the School of Social Work, both here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. If you want to join our conversation, your questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Returning to the All Kids program, we were speaking of it being a sort of a model or an exemplary kind of program, but it also, in the position paper that's on the Electing Healthcare website, mentions some problems with it, perhaps being too generous to people who are not poor, that the cost is actually quite an alarming issue that the state has to deal with.
The debate in October of 2005 when this passed was indeed a debate of, yes, this is a laudatory goal. Mm-hmm. Now how are we going to pay for it? And that's exactly what Treasurer Topinka is talking about in her position paper as well. She's saying, I'm all in favor of children's care, but how are we going to pay for this? And I think we don't have a full answer yet from either candidate about how we're going to finance this program.
If there are alternatives, what they would be and how they would be financed.
Right. I applaud the goal. I think that increasing access for children and their and mothers and families is extremely important. And I think that the idea, the theory of this program of having sliding scale premiums is important. And I also think that what's included in the program is important. You know, it includes really comprehensive health care, doctor's visits, hospital stays, prescription drugs, vision care, dental care, medical devices like eyeglasses, and asthma inhalers. I mean,
the things the kids really need.
Right, exactly.
This is a comprehensive program. And so the theory behind it, and I wouldn't want us to get totally lost simply in the financing discussion of it. Yeah, financing is an issue, but the model part is this comprehensive care, which is pretty well thought through.
Yes, and also it includes that kind of preventive focus that I think we all look toward so that you're not just entering the healthcare system at the end when there's some really awful, your kid is really horribly, horribly sick, when you could have had more of what we used to call, you know, the well baby, well child visits to keep kids healthy and getting the preventive care they need.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller to talk with. Let's do that. Someone in Charleston on line number 4. Good morning.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I have a question about the financing of the of healthcare, and I'm wondering if this is one is that a great big polar bear sitting in the corner of the room we don't want to look at or talk about, and that is the cost of the services that are provided by medical professionals. It would seem to me the community that ordinary civilians would be much more informed if we could hear the. A more elaborate justification of the costs or the charges assigned to various services that are provided. If one ever looks at an itemized hospital stay bill after returning home and doesn't require mental counseling, I believe that you truly is a healthy person. Anyway, do your guests have anything to say, or is possibly this is another discussion topic? And that is the cost of services. How can we civilians understand the continued increase in the cost of medical devices, medicines, doctor's visits, surgical procedures, consultations, x-rays, whatever is part of our wonderful American health delivery system? So I'll shut up and see if you all have an answer.
Okay. Thanks.
I don't think I have the answer. I certainly have the same set of questions when I look at bills. But I think any of us who look at the cost of doing business, whether it's professional fees or heating bills that have to be supported, we know that there are a lot of costs. On the other hand, I also think we have to be very proactive consumers. I'll give you a personal example. I was on the phone this morning with a patient liaison at a local healthcare provider contesting a medical fee that was charged to a member of my family, and they're going to check it out. Mm. So sometimes you do have to ask questions. On the other hand, we certainly do understand that it costs a lot to run a healthcare business, and one in which we have emphasized high technology in our care. We want the latest imaging device. We want the latest x-ray treatment or chemotherapy. And the price of having innovative treatment, the price of the research that goes into that, all increases the price. So as consumers, we have demanded things, too, that have increased price.
I would say, in reaction to the caller's excellent question, is what are we willing to do as citizens? And let me just give you an example. One of the largest growing costs of healthcare, be it all kids or Medicaid or any other healthcare, is the growing cost of prescription drugs. Because prescription drugs are the preferred treatment by many, and because of the growing cost. And the question is, are we willing as citizens to demand that our regulators do something about those prescription drug prices? So far, the answer has been no, but that's one handle one could take. Certainly other countries, Canada, European countries, Japan, all have far stricter controls on prescription drug prices than we do in this country.
One other issue that this raises for me is the issue of managed care in the Medicaid mm-hmm. program, which you also deal with in the background paper. It's something that Illinois hasn't availed itself of. Is that correct in Medicaid?
Well, Illinois hasn't done as much of managed care as other states have, but the premise behind the All Kids program is that it will be administered through managed care, and part of the theory is that there's a particular type of managed care that would be used in All Kids, and should save actually a good deal of money.
We have several calls to talk with, and we're growing short on time. We have less than 10 minutes left. Let's carry on here and speak with someone in Champaign, line number one. Good morning.
Hi. I had a question about the All Kid program. Your guests were saying that...
I'm sorry, you're cutting out. Can you...
Okay. I'll call back. Thank you.
Oh, sorry. Okay. All right. Well, we'll hopefully talk with that caller again. We'll talk with someone in Urbana next, line number two. Good morning.
Hi. Just another factor, and I learned this from listening to this show, the insurance premiums that the medical people have to pay are based on a lie, as far as what I've learned, in that it hasn't cost the insurance money, the insurance companies, anywhere near what they have jacked up the prices like. And anytime you're addressing any of these issues, I think you ought to be looking at that too, that we're being gouged by, that the medical community is being gouged by insurance companies without good reason. I'll hang up. Bye-bye.
Okay. Okay, well, not sure what show that she may have gotten that from. Have to go back and look at the archives. And
all I would say is that the issue of what insurance companies charge is very complex, and it depends on what we're talking about. Are we talking about medical malpractice insurance, which it sounds what the caller was talking about, or are we talking about health insurance premiums? And it is true that health insurance premiums have gone up again rather considerably. And again, that's something worth having a public debate about, is do we want to do anything about those rising health insurance premiums?
Okay. I want to make sure that we take some time to talk about mental health, which you haven't really touched upon too much in this hour. Mental health is almost 10% of the total Medicaid spending. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I think that's one of the surprises that people have, is that it is such a significant part of Medicaid spending. And increasingly, if you look at it from the other side, it's an increasingly important source of revenue for mental health services. I think historically, when we think about the mental health system, you think of it, especially for people with severe mental illness, we sort of think of it as a state-supported, state-operated system where people stayed in the hospital a long time. That situation started to change rapidly in the 1970s, and Medicaid was a key factor because Medicaid paid for a significant part of care in nursing homes. So in the 1970s, we saw a lot of people leave mental hospitals for nursing homes, and the state begin to shift the cost of providing care to the federal government through the Medicaid program. In the 1990s, we started to shift to Medicaid for outpatient care. Some states did this much more than Illinois. We're at, I believe, ranked 34th in our per capita Medicaid expenditures for mental health.
How about that? Well, you know, returning to the issue of the candidates and what their positions are, in the background paper, you argue that the candidates are seem to be paying scant attention to the issue of mental health care.
Yes, we find that, I think, mental health tends to be a low priority, drops off the radar screen very quickly unless there's a particular issue that comes up. Unfortunately, in Illinois, I think one of the things we hear most often is around a hospital closure and the loss of jobs that may occur with a hospital closure. And yet, if we look at it from the comparison to other states, we still spend more on hospitals and less on community care than comparable states. We need to think about what the quality of care is for people with severe mental illness and improving the continuum of care for them in the community. And that's a hard topic to, you know, it's not a sexy topic for any candidate, like mental health, who wants, it's stigmatized still, so we don't talk about it very much.
Which is maybe one of the reasons we should talk about it more.
Yes.
Okay. We have just about 4 minutes left, unfortunately. There's a lot more we could talk about. I wanted to sort of see if we can provide some guidance, or you can, with regard to the candidates' positions and maybe the contrast so that people have some basis for understanding their positions with regard to Medicaid.
I would say that the the basic difference is that the governor has emphasized access issues in his health care statements and has talked about All Kids Care and the Health Care Justice Act. All of them are designed to increase access, and Treasurer Topinka has emphasized more cost issues and cost containment issues. And if I had the ideal position, I'd have them both talking about both as opposed about one versus the other. But I think that's the basic difference between the two.
Is there a clear sense that either candidate is looking ahead as the costs continue to escalate? Down the road, you know, that we're hearing the treasurer saying, you know, around, look, folks, around 2010, you know, we're going to be, you know, facing severe budget deficits. And all of the money that is the growing tax revenues are going to pay off our current obligations, or, you know, the pension funds and all the things that we've been kind of shortchanging. Is either candidate sort of addressing that?
Put it this way, whoever is elected will have to deal with it. We know that.
What's interesting to me, Jack, is that even though we started this program by saying Medicaid is the single largest spending issue, from what I can tell, neither candidate has spent an enormous amount of time talking about Medicaid. And I think it's because they understand that you only can get yourself in trouble as a candidate by talking about this issue.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to say that we're running out of time. We have just about a minute or so left, and we have a couple callers that we won't be able to include, and I apologize to them. I think we'll need to take this topic up again as it relates to the election. But sort of as a way of wrapping up, do you have some suggestions for voters who want to understand these issues with regard to the candidates' positions? What kind of questions should we be asking?
I think voters should have the courage to ask the question, what is your position on health care? Come to community meetings with candidates, look on web pages, talk with people, and raise the issue of what are your concerns about health care and about Medicaid in specific.
And I would say, with respect to kid care, I would encourage voters to ask, how are you going to pay for it? This is a great program. What specific ways? Because if you can't pay for it, you're not going to be able to implement this wonderful program.
And this all relates to, obviously, the gubernatorial candidates, but also for the state legislature and to some extent the congressional candidates, yes, because this is a federal-state partnership.
This is a federal-state partnership. Your congressional candidates are important, too.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to stop there. I will promise, though, that we will resume this topic on another day on this show. And it's one that is increasingly important, obviously, so we'll take it up again. Our guests have been Bob Rich, Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and Wynn Kaur, Dean of the School of Social Work, both here at the University of Illinois at Champaign, Urbana-Champaign. And also, let me mention a television program airing on WILL-TV entitled Electing Healthcare, Friday, September 29th, 8 to 9 p.m. And this is going to be a panel discussion with several people, including some of our guests here and others, and we'll talk more in depth about the issues involved in healthcare and the election at that time.